And that was Billy Bragg and his song Between the Wars. Good news for Free Radio Santa Cruz listeners. As I mentioned in my last broadcast, it appears that Free Radio has found a studio in Santa Cruz. And I don't know if actually this was, I think this happened through the collective itself, so we got to pay ourselves $500 that I've been promising anyone who actually finds us the studio space for a year. So that's extra good for us because we don't have much in the way of a budget. Our membership has shrunk. People don't want to be a part of the Free Radio Collective unless they're in a studio to do Free Radio Collective programs from. But that's going to be happening, and it's also going to be happening with an incoming phone line probably in a week or so, maybe a week or two, I don't know. So in the future, you will be able to call into the show. It won't simply be a recorded show as this current show is. So, hooray! And that's good news for me and good news, I think, for listeners who are interested in actually getting in touch with us during the airtime and passing on reports of what's happening in the community. And now some sad news. Mike Rhodes, who's a Fresno activist who I've interviewed quite regularly on this show, and is the author of Dispatches from the War Zone, which is a history of his involvement with homeless activism in Fresno between 2002 and the present, or a couple years ago anyway, sent me the following letter, dated February 21st. I had some difficult bad news to share with you. In January 2018, I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. What that means is that I have lung cancer and it has spread to other places in my body. In this case, the cancer has spread to the bones, lymph nodes, and brain. This is not good. The doctor says I might have a year to live. I discovered the cancer because of a pain in my hip which did not go away. As you know, I exercise, eat well, don't smoke, never did, and take good care of myself, so I was really shocked with the diagnosis. My Kaiser primary care physician did an x-ray of my hip and discovered the cancer. The discovery led to more x-rays, which found the cancer in several places, upper spine, lower spine, and hip. I have been in radiation treatment for the last 2 weeks to address the bone cancer. Yesterday, February 20th, that is, Pam and I went to the Bay Area to have them do a radiation treatment on 7 small cancerous growths in my brain. The trip did not go well. In preparation for the treatment, they did another MRI and found 30 growths or more. Too many to be treated with the tools they had available. They were going to use a cyber knife to selectively zap the growths, but there are just too many for that technique. The next option for the brain cancer is to go at it with a full brain radiation treatment. That is not good because the side effects are worse than using the cyber knife, but allowing the cancer to grow in my brain is not an option. The other way to attack the cancer is with chemotherapy and immunotherapy. I will probably start immunotherapy next week. I'm cautiously optimistic about this treatment because it will empower my immune system to fight the cancer. It has been explained 2 different ways to me. I was told that immunotherapy will unmask cancer cells so my immune system can attack and kill them. I like the sound of that. 2, I was told the drug I will be taking for the immunotherapy will hype up my immune system and make it more aggressive, attacking the cancer and anything else it might perceive as being a threat. That could lead to it attacking other parts of my body, like the colon, for example, and causing significant damage. Next in line of treatment options is the traditional chemotherapy. My doctors say that all the above treatments will push back but not cure the cancer. I think that is just too far along to hope for a cure, but if things went really well, I could live a year or 2 longer. I really wish that all this was not true and that I would wake up from this nightmare, but just like Trump being in the White House, this is my reality. I'm not in very much pain right now. I have a great support team, my family, and I do appreciate every day I have left as long as my quality of life is good and the pain is not too great. I've had a good life, being able to do more things and go more places than I ever imagined, and feel that the work I have done was meaningful and helped change the world for the better. I'm extremely proud of my 2 daughters, deeply love both grandchildren, and was fortunate to be married to my best friend and partner, Pam Whalen, for 40 years this October. Several people have asked me if there's anything they can do to help. If I need anything, I will let you know. It would lift my spirit to know that you did one extra thing today, this week, or this month to bring us closer to peace, social, and economic justice. There are 2 projects that I helped to create that mean a lot to me, Community Alliance Newspaper in Fresno and the Central Valley Progressive PAC. And people can learn more about that by going to www.fresnoalliance.com. And the reason I read that detailed description by Mike Rhodes, and you can follow his health, by the way, on mikerrhodes.us/health-blog. Again, that's Miker Rhodes, spelled mikerrhodes.us/health-blog, all in small letters. And in terms of news from Fresno, Mike, a couple of weeks back, posted this comment on his Facebook page. The Fresno Bee has a front page article about the homeless no camping ordinance. The article says that homeless people are being forced to move daily, that there is no place for them to go that is safe and legal, that the ordinance is not helping to end homelessness, and that supporters of the law like it because it gives police the ability to force homeless people to move on. Supporters of the ordinance make it clear that they are not trying to help the homeless. The point of the law is to give the police leverage in forcing homeless people to keep on the move, thus making their lives more difficult. And there's a link to the article, which is titled, Some Applaud Fresno Camping Ban. The homeless say it's little more than pack, unpack, repeat. And at some point I may send this story out, and you can find it if you browse online for Fresno Homeless. You can tell really what's going on just by looking at the title of the story in the first few paragraphs. The title is Some Applaud Fresno Camping Ban. The homeless say it's little more than pack, unpack, repeat. And what's said is, in the initial paragraphs of the story, cruel. That's what the 62-year-old Madison Ellen called the city of Fresno's unhealthy and hazardous camping act. Round and round we go, he said, no matter where you go, you're being run off. The law, passed by the Fresno City Council in August, makes camping on public or private property without the owner's permission a misdemeanor punishable by a $1,000 fine or up to 6 months in jail. People camping illegally can have their belongings confiscated and be booked into jail. They can also allow police to take them to MAP Point, a clearinghouse for housing, shelter, health, and social services based at Poverello House. And I'm not going to read more of this right now. As I said, I may be putting it out as on part of the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom email. If you want to be a part of that email, just give me a call on the HUF line at 423-HUF, 423-4833, in area code 831, 423-4833. The point is that they title this law, the city of Fresno does, the Unhealthy and Hazardous Camping Act. But what it does is it punishes all camping on public and private property without the owner's permission. And who owns the public property? Well, we hope we do. But of course, as we found out during the prosecutions against peaceful homeless protesters 8 years ago in front of the county building, the county bureaucrats believe they own the property and they will move people away from it at their own whim and whatever wish they have. The update from activist David Silva, who has appeared on many, many editions of this show throughout the years and is still an active member of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, as well as being a constant fighter against the city's anti-homeless, Santa Cruz's anti-homeless sleeping ban law, which I gave you an update a few days ago. Silva is in a hospital, or at least he was, last I heard, a day ago, in Maputo, Mozambique, where he was traveling. And he, as far as I know, he's still on a respirator. His pneumonia was reportedly improving, but the hospital is trying to squeeze money out of whoever it can, which is now amounting to tens of thousands of dollars, and they're threatening to dump him into the worse hospital, the central hospital, at least as they describe it. And it's some observers watching don't know how much of this is a scam and how much of this is, it looks like the hospital is just trying to squeeze money out of David Silva's friends and so forth. But it's a difficult situation. I'll try to keep folks informed as to what's going on. And I believe some of his friends are following it on a Facebook page and trying to raise money for the hospital, but the amount of money mounts by $2,000 a day. So there's some hope that the Veterans Administration, which gives David some health coverage, is going to provide something, but it's also unclear what's going on there. I'm sorry to have this gloomy report about one of our own local activists, but that seems to be what's going on. So here's a report from local activist John Colby, which I received, almost a week ago now, on February 19th, I believe. And see what you think. Okay, well, I'm on the line with activist and researcher John Colby. Today is the 19th of February. Hi, John.
Hi.
So you've... You've been doing some research on a number of issues, but...
Well, not research, just advocacy.
And advocacy as well. What have you got on your plate right now?
Okay, individual Thomas Pugh or Pug, his last name is spelled P-U-G-H, was hospital dumped by Dominican Hospital on the 10th of February.
Right.
And then the next day he was, Brent Adams was called by the sheriff. What happened is that a Metro bus driver saw him at the bus stop where he'd been hospital dumped. He was only in a hospital gown, and he was in a wheelchair, and that had a walker strapped to the back. It was an oversized wheelchair. He's extremely obese. He probably weighs about 400 pounds or more.
Uh-huh.
He's very infirm, and he's also not lucid. Well, not that he's not lucid, but he's not in complete control of his faculties. He's not confident, basically, and able to take care of himself.
Now, have you had any interactions with Thomas Pugh independently of previous...
No, I haven't been able to speak to him.
Uh-huh.
I've been advocating that for him from information I've gathered from other people.
Mm-hmm.
So after Brent Adams The sheriff gave this guy a ride downtown. Then they called Brent Adams to try to get him housed. Brent gave him blankets, I understand, or at least he got clothes for him to wear. And so what Brent described to me, it was obvious that this guy is not able to take care of himself, that he's got mental health issues, that he's probably got a history of institutionalization, and that he has underlying medical conditions like untreated diabetes and heart disease, and that he might be slightly developmentally disabled. I was in contact with Thomas Pugh's defense attorney, Shala Khan. So she actually was going to try to make a defense on the basis of retaliation by the police and or the sheriff's office, because I don't even know who. Well, supposedly there were warrants issued for his arrest from an incident that happened at the hospital on, I believe it was December 14th. And then there was another incident that there were warrants for incidents on January 13th, which I believe was, and some contact with a police officer who I believe was Ken D. So basically the charges were that he assaulted a nurse, that he obstructed an officer, and that he committed assault and battery on an officer. And you can see the video, that Brent's video, and you know, you're talking to Brent. There's no way this guy could commit assault and battery at anyone. Any judge who would even let that go to trial is, in my view, guilty of misconduct and abuse.
I remember, John, when this story came out. Well, it was about a week and a half ago, and it was covered by a lot of media because Brent, as you know, videoed this whole thing. I think it's posted either on his Homeless Outside in Santa Cruz website.
Yeah, I know it's a video.
No, we're talking.
Actually, I sent the video up to the U.S. Senate.
Right. The reason I'm mentioning it, John, is because we are doing a radio broadcast, as you know. So I'm going to be kind of interrupting with little interjections, questions, and comments.
Okay, go on. I understand.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you know a lot of this stuff. That's not the issue between you and me. The issue is, you know, the uninformed observer or listener who doesn't. So do we know where Thomas Pugh is now, or do we have a court date for him?
That's the issue, is that on the 15th, he had pleaded not guilty, and I talked to his public defender, and I informed her of my belief that he was unfit to stand trial, and that he should be assessed by a mental health professional. And then the next day, suddenly there was some court action, and he pleaded. Two of the charges were dismissed in the interest of justice. And let me let you know that when I found out that that I had already filed, Health and Human Services, OIG complaint, and an FBI complaint about this individual. So the FBI and the OIG, from the way they were talking to me, they were basically involved starting to investigate.
What's the OIG, John?
It's Office of Inspector General. They investigate hospital dumping. In this case, they investigate hospital dumping, and they would investigate retaliation by law enforcement agencies on behalf of Dominican Hospital.
Okay.
Because basically, so what I'm alleging is that Dominican Hospital knew from the KRON news report that homeless advocates were going to be filing government complaints, and I had made a public records request to STR 911 and to the Sheriff's Department, letting them know that I was gathering evidence for the FBI and the HHS, OIG, and for other government federal law enforcement investigators, other federal law enforcement agencies. So they knew I was going to do it. And then a couple of days after I filed that public records request, that he was arrested. So that it seems like he was arrested, and that on bogus charges and retaliation for KRON's news report of complaints were going to be filed in me.
Although the incidents involved happened some weeks before, right?
Right, and the thing is, if he had these outstanding warrants, then when the sheriffs were called, when he was hospital-dumped, why didn't they arrest him?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't they arrest him and put him in jail on these warrants if he had outstanding warrants?
So he pled to one charge?
Well, after I informed the the public defender in an email and explained why I believe he was unfit, then there was a motion that was filed, I don't know by who, to suppress evidence. I would say that when you're suppressing evidence, in this case, it would be to suppress exonerating evidence. It was probably filed by the DA. And then he pled guilty, no contest, two of the charge of assaulting the nurse at Dominican was dismissed in the interest of justice. The charge of assaulting the police officer in January was, supposedly in January, was dismissed in the interest of justice. And then it was just a charge of obstructing a police officer, and he pled guilty, no contest to that.
And this obstructing a police officer was around what incident, supposedly, in terms of what behavior?
I don't know, because I haven't been able to get that information.
Mm-hmm.
But, no one's really being very forthcoming. I've been doing a lot of public records requests to try to get, you know, public records, which will tell me what's going on.
When did you make that request, John?
Well, I made numerous requests. I made requests to the city of Santa Cruz. I made requests to the county. The county basically says they're basically covering their asses. They're saying, first they're saying, we can't give you these records. They're saying the arresting agency was not the sheriff, was not the county, it was the FCPD. We suggest you contact them. And they're saying, anyways, we don't have these records.
Now, when did you file? So they responded promptly to the request saying, we don't have records.
Right. They're saying that not only did the county wasn't the arresting agency, they suggest that I call the FCPD, they suggest that I call the court, and they say, they claim that they don't have these records anyway.
And you made that request, what, about 2 weeks ago?
It was about maybe 10 days ago.
Around the same, shortly after?
I believe it was on February 8th that I made that request.
So you did it before Brent's video came out or after?
No, it was after. It was after.
Okay.
After I found out what was going on and I was gathering evidence. Because I made an initial request, and then I made a request. I wanted to see the warrants because the public defender basically was asking me questions about the warrants, and I got the impression that she hadn't seen the warrants, which is really strange.
Public defender's name?
Well, let me explain.
Yeah.
Usually warrants are in the court file, and the public defender would have access to them. And the impression I was getting was that she was asking me questions about dates on the warrants, but I had the impression that she didn't even have access to the warrants, which makes suggest to me that it was a false arrest, that these warrants didn't exist or they were fraudulent, and they're keeping them from the public defender, and they're keeping me from me and other agencies.
That's one interpretation. So what's the name of the public defender again?
Chahla, S-H-A-H-L-A, Khan, K-H-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after I inform her that this guy is probably unfit to stand trial, then the next day he pleads guilty to this one charge, and in there it says that the public defender concurs with his plea. But to me, that's fraud on this individual, because I'd let her know that this guy needed an assessment because he was probably unfit, and then the next day he pleads out.
What was he sentenced to?
He was sentenced to 42 days in jail. He had 26 days time served, and they waived the other 22 days on good behavior, and then they put him on court probation for, I believe, 6 months or a year.
And did you get
in any case, the thing was, I called the jail to find out if he was released that day, because I found out on the 15th. I found out the night it happened that day where he pleaded guilty and it said he was out of custody. I called the jail. They wouldn't tell me anything, but they did tell me that if a person was in the jail or sent to the jail and they were unfit, that they would psychiatric or psychological experts speak to him, and he would be turned over to...
So you called the jail on the 15th, and they said he wasn't there, or they just said they wouldn't give you information? Which?
They said that he was no long, that he wasn't in the jail, and they couldn't tell me when he was released.
Right. Have you checked any of the court records to see if he has an address? I guess I assume he's unhoused or homeless.
He's homeless. Yes.
Do you know anybody on the street who knows him?
Brent said he doesn't have any friends, but Brent says that he hangs around. He hangs out between around the Front Street bus stop near the CBS. So he hangs around in a very small area, which is kind of unusual. But in any case, he doesn't have any friends. Brent said that he told him, that Thomas Pugh told him, that he escaped from a transitional housing institution in Monterey before he came here, and somehow he got to Santa Cruz, I don't know. And Brent says this guy is so out of it that he thinks that Monterey is part of Santa Cruz. But anyway, so I called the FBI on the 15th. I said my fear that basically they were going to make this guy disappear. And the FBI assured me that the HHS was not going to, OIG was not going to allow this guy to be disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then that was on Thursday night. And so I wasn't able to call Friday to call the HSOIG.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI actually told me to call the HSOIG and said they will give you more information, which is really weird. They don't usually give information.
Well,
they take information.
You probably know what I think about these agencies, but John, hang on a second. You're outside in your vehicle yourself, correct?
Right.
Yes?
Yeah, what relevance does that have?
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, have you ever gone by this spot near CVS and seen if he's around?
No, I haven't, because, you know, I can't be driving around, you know, going around there. It isn't practical. You know, I need other agencies to basically, you know, do this for me and other people.
Well, I wish you luck with that. Yeah, I mean, you obviously, usually you're various places where you've slept in the past, as far as I know, have been relatively near to that spot. But, yeah, I mean, I understand. I'm not trying to derogate the work you're doing, though I'm skeptical of whether these agencies are going to do diddly squat.
Be on the lookout for him because Brent is more, you know, riding around on his bike.
Brent has, you know, had some success with that, too. Yeah. Anything else on this case?
But what I'm saying is Brent hasn't had any contact with Thomas Pugh, and he had contact with him before because he hangs out in this little area. So it sounds like he's not hanging out there. He's not there.
Gotcha.
Right. Okay. So in any case, last night I found out that he had a mugshot and that he had been arrested. That was yesterday was the
18th,
right?
The Sunday the 18th.
Okay. So, okay, he had been arrested on the 17th. And he had a mugshot, and he looked terrified in his mugshot. You got to look at his mugshot. It's in the email I sent ICC to you. He looks terrified. His eyes are as big as saucers. And then I called the jail, and they say he's not in our custody. This was the next day when I found out. And I saw the mugshot, and I call, and they say he's not in our custody.
What was the arrest? Do we know what the arrest was for?
Wait, just slow down, Robert. Slow down. So I asked them, was he in your custody? Was he booked in the jail in your custody yesterday when he was arrested? Because there's a mugshot. And they said, we can't tell you that.
Yeah, they generally don't give out information on people that aren't there. Whether that's legitimate or not, it's their standard practice. let me ask you, did you determine what he was arrested for this most recent time?
No, the mugshot didn't have any details of who the agency was arresting him was or what the charges were.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know why he was arrested or where he is now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to, for the last 4 days, I've been trying to get the FCPD to do a missing persons report on him. And the FCR-911 dispatches FCB officers to call me to file a missing persons report, but these officers never call me.
Yeah. Well,
finally, I talked to John Bush, Sergeant John Bush, last night,
mm-hmm.
and he was, like, really, really evasive and prevaricating and going back and forth. He claims that if the FBI and the HHASOIG contact the SCPD to locate Thomas Pugh, that even under subpoena, if Thomas Pugh doesn't consent to them giving up the location of them, of him, they won't do it.
I have no idea. I have no idea if that's true or not. But
bullshit.
Well, I don't know. Where's your contrary information? Have you got some other legal statute that says otherwise? I don't know.
Subpoena, if a federal agency subpoenas a police department to give them the location of someone,
I have no idea, man, but I can appreciate that may well be the case. Is there any other information you want to pass on?
So, at this point, I'm really scared because obviously what I get from the SCPD, the way they won't respond, and this is another thing, SCR 911 won't dispatch a sheriff's deputy to allow me to file a missing persons report with them. Because I told them this guy could be anywhere in the county. He could be somewhere out of the city at this point, and they will only dispatch SCPD officers. They refuse to allow me to talk to a sheriff's deputy.
Well, if you're interested, you know, I suggest you go up to the second floor of the sheriff, or the third floor of the county building, or wherever the hell they are, and go with someone with an audio recorder and attempt to file a report there, document that.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, on Tuesday, see, the problem is with the holiday, you know, no one's open.
Right,
Tuesday,
tomorrow.
They call, wait. On Tuesday, I'm going to call Adult Protective Services.
Yeah.
And I'm going to call the HSOIG, mm-hmm. and because Adult Protective Services is, you know, should be responding to protect this guy and, if he's infirm and he can't take care of himself.
Right, at another time, you and I are going to discuss any of the actual results of these calls over the last 5 years. But I thank you for what you've said over, you know, to give us the specifics of your interest, and in, particularly in Thomas Pugh. Is that his name?
Pug or Pugh. I don't know how it's
P-U-G-H, yeah. Okay. And I think that pretty much covers it, unless there's something you want to add.
My belief is that this is disabled people who are infirm get railroaded by the court all the time, by the police of the court all the time, and at this time they got caught with their hands in the cookie jar, so they're freaking out, and it's in their interest to make this guy disappear, so that's why I'm really scared for him.
Well, I appreciate your making that report public for people to hear.
And also I want to let you know that there are organizations which believe there's a civil case to be litigated on behalf of Thomas Pugh for hospital dumping and for retaliation by law enforcement in the court. And so, you know, they know basically they've also talked about, you know.
Well, if anything actually comes of this other than chitter-chatter on the phone and emails exchanged.
I'm just telling you what's in the.
If anything comes of this, I'd like to hear more about it, so keep us advised.
I'll tell you that. Okay.
Sound good?
Okay.
And we've been talking with?
John Colby.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
My neighbors don't drink at the local or have kippers for breakfast like me. The food that they eat smells disgusting. They'd rather drink coffee than tea. It's true that their kids are respectful. They gave me their seat on the bus, but it's just that there's so many of them that I fear what'll become of us. I'm not racist, all I want is to make things how they used to be. But change is strange, and nobody's listening to me. I cheered when our side won the Cold War, spread freedom and peace folks all around. Now there's folks speaking Russian in Tesco's. It's a shame the wall had to come down. I know some are fleeing from war zones to keep their young children from harm. But my parents stayed put through the Blitz years, and me, I was sent to a farm. Yeah, the sun shines, but sometimes I don't feel like this is my country. But to say so, oh no, I never get no sympathy. Once we ruled over an empire, so it feels like some kind of defeat to comply with rules drawn up by strangers and measure in meters, not feet. We don't want to go, but by jingo, if we can't be in charge, then we must. But don't be offended, dear neighbor, it's not you, this is all about us. But it's
that was another one by Billy Bragg, Full English Brexit. Of course, it's about the United Kingdom's exit from the European Union. And it's apparently an ironic song, which you might not get, but he's sort of lampooning or satirizing the oh, woe is us, we have to get away from these European Union people. I myself ambivalent about the whole issue of the English withdrawing from the European Union. I'm not a big fan of a lot of what the European Union does. But that's another issue. Here is an article from last Tuesday's Chronicle, Wrongly Convicted Rarely Get State Cash. Glenn Payne spent 13 years in prison for a 1991 child molesting conviction in San Jose based on hair identification evidence that has since been discredited. His record cleared. Payne, 55, no longer has to register as a sex offender and says he's regaining his peace of mind. What he and most others in similar situations are unlikely to gain is any financial compensation for their years behind bars. California uses state funds to compensate the wrongfully imprisoned at $140 for each day of their confinement, but they must file their claim within 2 years of their release and then must prove to a jury or a state board that they were innocent. Payne would not qualify. His two-year deadline expired in 2007, and though prosecutors concede he was wrongly convicted and his lawyers had not tried to present evidence that he was innocent, that can be especially hard to prove in older cases where evidence is often destroyed, as it was in Payne's case. As a result, the state seldom has to pay for the legal system's mistakes. The California Victim Compensation Board says it has received claims of innocence from 76 former inmates since 2006 and approved only 26 of them for a total compensation of $14.1 million. Payne was convicted of molesting a 2-year-old girl largely on the strength of testimony by a Santa Clara County forensic analyst who said hair found on Payne almost certainly came from the victim. Last year, the analyst recanted his testimony, saying it was based on an unreliable study. On January 29th, without objection from the prosecutor's office, a judge threw out Payne's conviction. I want to find housing, enjoy my life. I'm figuring out what tomorrow will be and what the next day, Payne said after the court hearing, which also freed him of the lifelong obligation to register as a sex offender. He has been homeless at times since his release from prison and recently has been living with his 87-year-old mother in San Jose. If he had applied for state compensation for the innocent by 2007 and received it, an unlikely outcome since his conviction was still on the books, it would have come to about $475,000 at $100 per day, the rate at that time. Such a large sum of money for someone like Glenn is the difference between adequate food, health care, and shelter, and homelessness, said Linda Starr, Santa Clara University law professor and executive director of the Northern California Innocence Project, which represented Payne in the proceedings that cleared him. He has never expressed to us any ideas of grandiosity or wealth. He truly wants to live quietly his life without the stigma of being a sex offender and the chaos and fear of being homeless and struggling with mental illness. According to the University of Michigan's National Registry of Exonerations, 185 people convicted of felonies in California in the past 40 years were later shown to be innocent, including 39 in the Bay Area. In addition to state compensation, wrongly convicted former prisoners can sue those responsible for putting them behind bars. Such suits occasionally succeed. At least 3 in recent years had accused San Francisco of falsifying or concealing evidence, and several similar suits in Los Angeles County have resulted in multi-million dollar settlements. More commonly, however, advocates for the wrongfully imprisoned point the finger at prosecutors accusing them of withholding crucial evidence. And suits against prosecutors are almost impossible to win. That was dramatically illustrated by a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2011 that threw out a New Orleans jury's $14 million damage award to a man who had spent 14 years on death row for killing he did not commit. John Thompson was nearing his execution date in 1999 when his lawyers learned that prosecutors had withheld blood evidence that would have cleared him in a related carjacking case. After a judge dismissed the case, Thompson was retried for murder and acquitted, and then sued for a violation of his right to a fair trial. Prosecutors are immune under federal law and the laws of most states, including California, from damages for their conduct in presenting a case. How nice for them. But Thompson's suit accused the office's chief prosecutor, Harry Connick Sr., of failing to train his subordinates in their duty to turn over evidence that could help the defense. Jurors found the elder Connick derelict and awarded Thompson $1 million for each year of his imprisonment, but the Supreme Court said none of the evidence against Connick met the high standard of proving the prosecutor legally responsible for Thompson's near execution. In the 5-4 ruling, Justice Clarence Thomas said Thompson had to show, quote, a pattern of prosecutorial misconduct that would demonstrate deliberate indifference to his rights and a single failure to disclose evidence just wasn't enough. Such legal barriers exist because you want to protect prosecutors from these lawsuits, even though you can point to these awful cases, said David Devine. I'm not sure why you want to protect them. That's my addition. A law professor at UC Hastings in San Francisco. Society has chosen to accept the possibility of erroneous convictions, he said, in the name of making sure that these public servants are not deterred from doing what they have to do. You know, convict poor people of crimes like, illegal lodging or other poverty crimes such as under the sleeping ban. We have prosecutions that are happening from the police who are acting as prosecutors in literally thousands of cases against the homeless. The only available remedy for a prosecutor's misdeeds, he said, is the inadequate compensation the state offers to those who can demonstrate their innocence. The door is a little more open for suits accusing police of evidence tampering that led to wrongful convictions. Officers and the city or county that employed them can be held responsible for violating rights that were so clearly established that any competent officer would have been aware of them. And then there's more discussion in this article by Bob Agelko in the San Francisco Chronicle from last February 20th. Wrongfully convicted rarely get state cash. And here's a brief update from the Orange County Register entitled, "Here's how many Santa Ana River homeless people have been moved to motels and when the encampment will be entirely clear." Again, notice, even in cities where they're providing some real alternatives to everyone, supposedly, who is being displaced under federal scrutiny, there is still this main focus on eliminating an encampment, as though that's the big deal, which it is, as it is here in Santa Cruz. Eliminating the San Lorenzo Park encampment is the big point of the February 28th cleanup. And not just a cleanup. Cleanups in the past have involved homeless people leaving and then coming back a few days later. This is the removal of a campground. Here's what it says about the Orange County situation. "In the past week alone, 424 homeless people have been living in the Santa Ana River tent city. They were moved to local hotel rooms and provided vouchers allowing them to stay there free of charge for at least a month. That total as of Wednesday morning represents an enormous portion of the riverbed encampment population, which advocates estimated earlier this year was between 500 and 1,000 people. It is unclear how many people remained in camp on Wednesday, but it's likely that somewhere between several dozen and 200 people are still living there. Orange County Council Leon Page said he expects all homeless people to be out of the riverbed by the end of Friday if the county continues clearing the encampment at its current pace. There's no firm deadline for the county to dismantle the encampment, but people must leave the area when approached by county personnel or risk being arrested. By 9 a.m. Wednesday, a formerly dense northeastern portion of the two-mile encampment had been entirely deserted by its former inhabitants. More than 180 homeless people were transported to motels on Tuesday. People remain camped in more southern portions of the tent city, which runs between Taft Avenue and the I-5 freeway in Anaheim and Orange. But county officials said they think many people from the yet-to-be-cleared sections have already accepted motel vouchers and left the area, potentially allowing outreach workers and deputies to move out stragglers more quickly in the next couple of days. County workers began the process of clearing the southern camps on the river's west side by 1:30 p.m., in the wake of the mass move-out, mounds of debris littered the eastern river berm between Catella and Taft Avenues. Page said he expects the cleanup of abandoned belongings to stretch into next week. The county's more extensive cleanup action, its stated reason for evicting people from the flood control channel in the first place, could take 3 months. Imagine if you were forced to leave your home under a deadline. What kind of debris you would leave behind? It would be it would make the amount of trash left by homeless folks or abandoned property look minuscule, it would be my view. Getting back to the article, the plan to move encampment inhabitants to motels is the result of recent negotiations between county officials and attorneys for seven homeless plaintiffs who sued the county and three local cities on January 29th, alleging the recent riverbed election evictions violated their civil rights. U.S. District Judge Daniel O. Carter helped broker their deal and continues to oversee the process of clearing the encampment to ensure it's conducted efficiently, according to plan, and without violating the homeless people's rights. The county is temporarily housing homeless people at local motels until it can create more shelter beds and other accommodations, or at least while the federal judge is looking. This is the same story being used by officials in Santa Cruz, where they've created this token smaller River Street campground, which I've talked about earlier, behind barbed wire and fences along Highway 9, which you're not allowed to walk to or walk from, which houses less than 10% of the homeless population in Santa Cruz and supposedly is going to be replaced by more significant services. This is a claim made by the county and the city, specifically the city actually here in Santa Cruz, with some supposed buy-in from the county, although it's not really clear what they're buying into. And you'll hear activist Brent Adams talking about this later. Anyway, this is most of an article in the Orange County Register, which has been extensively covering this. And it's really interesting that the judge actually has been personally kind of walking the Santa Ana Riverbed Tent City area and scolding the deputies when they attempt to take action to make arrests and hold people hostage, I should say, you know, in law enforcement arms before they get the social service, supposed social services that the judge has decreed. I'll continue to probably be following this, although I'm skeptical of this, as well as skeptical of what's going on, much more skeptical of what's happening here in Santa Cruz. Nobody's getting 30 days in a motel in Santa Cruz that is being evicted from the San Lorenzo campground on Wednesday. And nobody's getting a guaranteed spot in the River Street campground that's supposed to be replacing it. So that's a real difference.
It might have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies a rich lady who's crying over luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathize with her. But he thinks that he should warn her that the third world is just around the corner. In the Soviet Union, a scientist is blinded by the resumption of nuclear testing, and he is reminded that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's optimism fell at the first hurdle. In the cheese pavilion, the only noise I hear is the sound of someone stacking chairs and mopping up spilled beer, and someone asking questions and basking in the light of the 15 fame-filled minutes of the fanzine writer. Mixing pop and politics, he asks me what the use is. I offer him embarrassment for my usual excuses, while looking down the corridor out to where the van is waiting. I'm looking for the Great Leap Forward. Jumble sales are organized and pamphlets have been posted. Even after closing time, there's still parties to be hosted. You can be active with the activists or sleeping with the sleepers while you're waiting for the Great Leap Forwards. One leap forwards, two leaps back. Will politics get me in a sack? Waiting for the Great Leap. Well, here comes the future and you can't run from it. If you've got a blacklist, I want to be on it. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. Well, it's a mighty long way down rock and roll from top of the pops to drawing a thumb. You're waiting for the Great Leap Forward. If no one out there understands, just start your own revolution and cut out the middle man. Great Leap Forward. A perfect world, we're all singing tune, but this is reality, so give us a run. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. So join the struggle while you make the revolution, is just a t-shirt away. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward.
And that was Billy Bragg, Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. This is the midst of Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. If you have any reports from the street, if you have any reactions to the show, if you're interested in joining Free Radio, or if you want to do some work around homeless civil rights, give a call to Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the Huff line, H-U-F-F, at 423-HUFF. 423-4833. So I find I'm running behind time on what I'd hoped to put out on the show. So some of the interviews that I promised earlier, Stacy of Berkeley, Pat Colby of Santa Cruz, and Peggy Lee Kennedy of Venice and Los Angeles, gonna have to wait. And my apologies to those folks. What I'm going to play now is a lengthy interview with Brent Adams about the local scene, and it's kind of a regular feature of this show, and I think a good one. Brent and I don't agree on everything, and yet we seem to be able to share a lot of useful information. Let's hear that, and then we're going to probably launch pretty directly after that, maybe with a break or two, into a flashback from, well, we'll talk about that when we get to it.